the Brain Science Podcast, the podcast for everyone who has a brain. And I'm your host, Dr. Ginger Campbell. On the Brain Science Podcast, we explore how recent discoveries in neuroscience are unraveling the mysteries of how our brains make us who we are. For more information, including show notes, links to previous episodes, and information about how to subscribe, please go to the website brainsciencepodcast.com. We also have a discussion forum at brainscienceforum.com, and you can send me email at docartemis@gmail.com. Welcome back to the Brain Science Podcast. This is episode 38. Today I have a very special guest, Jeff Hawkins, author of On Intelligence. When I originally reviewed Jeff's book back in the summer of 2006 for the Sci-Fi Show, the experience inspired me to start the Brain Science Podcast. So I'm really excited to have Jeff on today. There's one thing I would like to mention before I get into the interview. I want to let you know that there is a new episode of my other podcast, Books and Ideas, out, and it is an episode about meditation. I didn't put it in the Brain Science Podcast feed because it's not that much about meditation and the brain, although the subject does come up. So especially for those of you who are waiting for an episode about meditation, I think you will enjoy the episode. It is an interview with forensic psychologist Delaney Dean. And you can find that at booksandideas.com and in iTunes. Before we get into Jeff's interview, there's one thing that I have to warn you about. Jeff was on a cell phone while we were talking, and so his voice is not as clear as it could be. I want to apologize for that and promise you that in the future I will be more insistent with my guests to try to get them to avoid using cell phones. However, despite the sound quality, Jeff's enthusiasm for brain science definitely comes through, and I know you're going to enjoy the interview. Please stay tuned at the end for some closing announcements. Ever since the book On Intelligence was featured back in episode 2 of the Brain Science Podcast, I've wanted to interview the book's author, Jeff Hawkins. So today I'm really proud to be able to welcome Jeff onto the podcast. Jeff, I really appreciate your taking the time to talk with us today.
No problem, Ginger. I'm happy to be here.
For the sake of my listeners who may not have read On Intelligence and may not be familiar with your work, could you start by just telling us a little bit about your background?
Yeah, so I have this sort of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde type of lifestyle. I've done sort of two different careers. I'm 51 years old, and I've worked for many years in the computer world, so many people know me from that. I was the founder of a couple of companies, Palm Computing and Handspring, and I was the designer of the Palm Pilot and the Trio smartphone. But throughout all that time, going back to 1979, actually my main interest has been neuroscience and brains. And so I've been sort of living in two worlds at once. And as part of that, I did a stint as a graduate student at Berkeley in from 2001 to 2004. I started and ran a neuroscience institute that was focused specifically on the theory of neocortex. And that was actually very successful. That still continues on now at UC Berkeley. But my interest has always been understanding how the neocortex works and some other related brain areas like the thalamus, understanding from a theoretical point of view and a biological point of view, and then building machines that work on those principles. And we've made a lot of progress in this area. And my book was, when it came out, I guess it was in 2004, when it came out, we've made a fair amount of progress understanding how the neocortex functions and forms memories. And the book described that, and since then we've figured out more about that, and we've figured out how to make machines that work on the same principles.
I want to ask you a question about this. I think we're just about the same age. I think I might be a year older than you, but I also came out of engineering school around the same time as you did, but went to grad school and ended up in medical school. I was interested in the fact that your first job was at Intel, because wasn't that in the very early beginnings of microprocessors?
Yeah, it was. you know, I was right out of school, so I had really nothing to do with any of that. But it was just when the microprocessor was starting to become popular. I think the 8086 had just been introduced or something like that. And they'd only been around for a few years before then.
My husband was starting his job as an electrical engineering professor in 1977, actually, and we were using the Motorola chip. We had something called a D2 kit that we had to program in hexadecimal. I can still remember that.
Yeah, in fact, it was a great time to get into the mobile computing or the computing industry. But my story is in the fall of 1979, there was an issue of Scientific American, and the September issue was always dedicated to a particular topic. And in that year, the topic was the brain. And many neuroscientists remember this issue because it was influential for quite a few people. And it had all these stories about the brain, about the neuron, about diseases of the brain, and so on. And the very last article was written by Francis Crick, who was one of the co-discoverers of the DNA molecule structure. And Francis had turned his interest to neuroscience, and he wrote a story or piece. I think it was called Thinking About Thinking, but I'm not sure about that title. But anyway, he essentially said, look, you just read all these facts about brains, and people act as if we know how it works, but in reality, we really have no idea how it works. We have all this data, but no overarching theory. And the words he used was, what is conspicuously lacking is a framework to understanding these different ideas. And that struck me as both correct and a real challenge, and it got me excited about brains. I said, you know what, I'm going to work on that. I just started the job as an electrical engineer, and I said, I'm going to become a brain scientist, and I'm going to dedicate my life to understanding how brains work, and that's what got me going for this field.
The only reason that I took that aside into talking about your work at Intel is that I think as we get into our conversation, I want my listeners to understand that you are a person uniquely qualified to comment on the difference between brains and computers because you really understand how they work at the very guts level, which a lot of us don't. So that's really why I wanted to bring that piece out of your background there.
Okay, well, there's probably some truth to that, yeah. So, in fact, it's an interesting commentary on this because when I first started studying brains, it was intuitively obvious to me that brains do not work at all like computers. And I understand computers pretty well. You know, I studied quantum mechanical devices in college, and I knew operating systems. So I understand computers pretty well. But it was just obvious to me that brains didn't work in this on the same principles. But it wasn't obvious to a lot of other people. Since the beginning of the computer era, back starting when Alan Turing wrote his famous paper about computing machinery and intelligence in 1950, since that time, people thought of brains like a computer, and that we could just program computers to be, and they would do things like brain does. And most people who were trying to build intelligent machines thought there was nothing to be learned by looking at brains. They just thought it was a waste of time, and that there's no reason to look at brains. And I went through a lot of roadblocks because my approach from the very beginning was, hey, if we're going to build intelligent machines, we have to understand how brains work, and they work on some different principle. We need to understand those principles before we can go about trying to, build a machine that works like that. But that certainly was not a well-accepted idea back then.
Can we talk a little bit about your book? I know it's been a few years since you wrote it, but I'm sure the ideas are still pretty fresh in your mind. In your prologue, you said you wanted to propose a new theory of intelligence. Why do you think we need a new theory? Or did we have an old theory?
No, we don't have an old theory. Well, it depends on who you speak to. The whole field of brains and intelligence and intelligent machines, there are thousands and thousands of people who are interested in this work in various fields. There's linguistics experts, there's computer scientists, there's neuroscientists. We have tens of thousands of neuroscientists in this country. I mean, so this is a big area, and there's lots of ideas. So on the one hand, I generally like to say, we don't need new ideas. We need to understand what we already have. But when you're writing a book, you really need to say, look, there's a synthesis here that I don't think the reader will have ever heard before. And I'm presenting it, and I called it new at that time. And there's some very new things about it. But in general, there hasn't been a unified or any sort of coherent overarching theory about brains and brain function. That's what I said earlier about Francis Crick. He said that we're missing that theoretical framework. And then, you know, while I was trying to do my book, and I think I succeeded in, to some extent, was providing a theoretical framework for understanding a lot of disparate pieces of data about brain science and behavior.
Did you ever get to talk to Crick in person before he died?
Yes, I did. In fact, I got to know Crick and James Watson fairly well. I had a nice social tea with Francis Crick down in San Diego, and then I gave a talk at the Salk Institute where he was hanging out at the time, because he'd spent a lot of part of his life interested in neuroscience.
I've got to interview Christoph Koch, but I obviously missed Crick because he's been gone for a few years. So one of the things that stuck in my mind about your book was that you criticized the approaches taken by artificial intelligence and neural networks, especially for their failure to consider how brains really work. What do you think are the most important features that we really should be taking into account?
Well, just for starters, we have one example of intelligence, and that's the biological brain. People have tried to replicate brain functions in computers for many, many years and have generally failed. I don't want to say completely, because there's all kinds of things computers do that are useful. But, you know, the basic ideas of how we, the most simple things that humans do, perceiving the world, vision, language, motor control, these are things computers can't do. And so I always start off by saying, let's study brains. You know, that's the only way to get to this point. Now, at this point, I have a lot of understanding about the difference between computers and brains. But I just, in the beginning of my book, I just had to make the case that you have to stop thinking about a brain like a computer. And most people don't realize how poor an understanding we have about brains, and they didn't understand how poorly we've done at replicating brains in computers. My intent was less to criticize, it's just to point out the state of these two endeavors. Brains are still a mystery. I think I call it the last great terrestrial frontier of science. You know, it's like one of the last things that's so everyday important to us that we really have very little idea on how it works. And I also just wanted to point out that, you know, some people have the impression like, oh, don't we have intelligent computers? Can't they do these things? And the answer is no, they can't. I just need to make that case before I said, look, we need to rethink our whole approach to this. And you have to realize how much we struggled with this over the decades.
That was something I came to the book sort of knowing. So I guess that point might have gone right by me, since I wasn't the one needing that point.
Well, you'd be surprised how many people, lay people, would just say, oh, yeah, we understand how the brain works. I read their stories all the time in the paper. Or, don't we have, you know, I read about that computerized car. We must understand how computers can see or understand language and things like that. And it's not true. So I did need to sort of set that level of expectation.
I was wanting to sort of get into a couple of these little features that brains do that really are different from computers, or at least the way they do them is very different. Can you talk a little bit about the importance of feedback?
I'll step a little bit back from that. A brain is not a computing function. It doesn't have software. It doesn't, you know, it's not programmed to do anything. The best way to think about brain is it's a form of memory. It's a memory system. When you're born, your brain knows very little about the world. It doesn't know about cars and trucks and buildings and books and podcasts and doctors. It doesn't know any of this stuff. You're born with sort of a brain that knows nothing about the world, and you have to learn these things. No one programs it. You have to learn it, and you learn it only one way, through exposure to patterns in the world through your senses. And so you have to start thinking about brains as a memory system. And it doesn't work like the kind of memory we have in a computer. It works on different principles, but in some sense, it stores information and it can retrieve it. And that's what you're doing when you're thinking and when you're perceiving the world. And you are taking new patterns in from your senses, and it's recalling stuff that's previously been stored in your memory. And my work is all about understanding how those memory systems work. How does the brain memory system work, and how is it different than other types of memories we might be familiar with? One of the clues that helped me make progress on this problem was a biological fact, that if you look at brains, there's this huge amount of feedback going on. That is, the information comes from your senses, and it goes to different brain regions and different areas of the neocortex, for example. But information is also flowing backwards. And many people think of it more like a computer, like you have your inputs, you process it, and then you have an output. That's what the brain must be like, a computer. But in reality, it looks like as much information is flowing backwards as it is going forward. And this was a big clue, because most people's models of thinking and brain function ignored the feedback. This is just one of the things that they ignored. Another one is the importance of time. But feedback was one of those big clues that the anatomist told us, hey, brains have all this feedback. It's there. And yet you look at theoreticians who would say, like, well, I don't think it's doing anything because, you know, I don't understand why I need the feedback. And they would literally write papers saying, I don't think the feedback is important. But it's a dominant feature of all brain regions, and clearly, in my mind, it was important. So that was just one of the clues that we used to say, look, you know, we can't ignore this. There's several things we can't ignore, and that was one of them. And I can talk about its role in brain function if you want, at least in the cortex, and how I see the importance of it.
Yeah, let's come back to that in just a minute. Your work kind of has focused on the cortex. Would you like to just kind of explain why you choose to sort of isolate down to mainly the cortex?
Yeah, sure. If you look at a human brain, and if you open up the skull and you see that wrinkly surface on the top, that's the neocortex. And it's actually a thin sheet of cells. It's about 3 or 2 millimeters thick, so double business cards type of thing. And it's a big sheet. It's like the size of a dinner napkin. And it gets wrinkled up to get in your head. Now, that neocortex is volumetrically about 60 to 70% of the volume of your brain. So it's a dominant feature of a human brain in terms of its size. Besides its size, what's the most interesting thing about it is the cortex is where we store the majority of learned knowledge in the world, the vast majority of it. The cortex is in charge of all high-level language. So all the meanings of words and how you use language, it's all neocortex, understanding language and creating language. The neocortex is almost completely responsible for vision. You know, there's a few other areas, but mostly it's the organ of vision. So everything you know about how the world looks and expectations about visual things is all in the neocortex. And it's also the neocortex is in charge of all high-level motor control. And so like planning and moving and creating my speech right now. So it is the place which is mediating all high-level, almost all high-level thought processes in the brain. And if you're interested in understanding language or building machines that can see, for example, in the way that brains do, it's the cortex you want to start with. It's not we can ignore the other parts of the brain, but it's a good place to start. And another thing that's great about it is that all mammals have a neocortex and non-mammals don't. But the neocortex came onto the scene evolutionary time fairly recently. And it got large very rapidly in evolutionary time. And so it's a fairly uniform structure. It doesn't have a lot of, even though it does all these different things, it's actually very, very similar throughout. And so it gives you the promise that you can understand a lot about what the brain is doing, about what thought processes are, without studying a lot of different things. In fact, this is one of the premises of the theory that I worked on, and it's well known in the neuroscience world, that the way the brain actually does language and hearing and motor control and so on, it's actually the same. This has been known now for almost 30 years. So it gives you the promise of understanding a whole bunch of high-level thought processes all at once if you can understand how the neocortex works.
Would you explain why the work of Vernon Mountcastle is so important?
Sure. Vernon Mountcastle is a neurophysiologist at Johns Hopkins. He studied a lot of different aspects of the brain, but he's really focused on the neocortex. He wrote a wonderful book and many papers about the neocortex. In one of his papers, which he wrote in 1979, which I read for the first time, I think, in like 1985 or so, it was in a little monograph, actually. And this is the first time I read this idea. I think it was the first time it was published. But he made the argument that if you look at the different areas of the neocortex, the areas involved in vision and language and motor control and touch and so on, that the architecture, the details of how the cells are arranged and how they connect to one another, is nearly identical everywhere. This idea that it looks similar has been known back to the turn of the previous century, back to Cajal, back in 1900. But Vernon Mountcastle made the following speculation. He said, not only do these areas look the same, but I believe they're doing the same thing. That a vision area is doing the same thing as a language area, which is doing the same thing as a motor output area. And he says what makes it a visionary is because it's hooked up to the eyes. What makes it an auditory area is because it's hooked up to the ears. But the fundamental property that these different areas of the neocortex, what they're doing is the same. And this, to me, is one of the greatest discoveries in science. It's one of these things you look at and nature surprises you and you go, oh, that is so amazingly beautiful. And it explains so many things we know about trauma and about physiology. And it gives us, like, isn't this beautiful that nature's come up with a single way of doing all these different things? And that, to me, was just a tremendously liberating idea. Now you could search for that sort of Uber algorithm, that Uber idea, those principles that span modality, span behavioral tasks. That really clarified it for me quite a bit. It's just one of those great discoveries, and Vernon Ramkow was the first guy to basically nail it, saying, here's, you know, not only do things look the same, but they're doing the same thing.
And now there's lots of evidence to support his predictions.
Yes, there is. In fact, there was a lot of evidence back when he wrote it, but it was such a unexpected idea that not everybody liked it. And over time, I run a whole bunch of conferences with neuroscientists, and I usually start by asking how many people believed in that. And in the beginning, when I started asking people, I would find maybe a little bit less than 0.5%, half of the people, neuroscientists, would believe what Vernon Mountcastle proposed. Today, I don't have a number on it, but it's well over half. I would say it's more like 70, 80, or 90% of neuroscientists who will say, yeah, there's truth to that. And the evidence is overwhelming. The only obstacle people have with it is it's kind of hard for them to believe. If you spent your life studying vision and you come up with all these vision algorithms in speculation how the brain does vision, and someone comes along and says, well, you know, that there isn't a vision algorithm. It's just a cortical algorithm that works with vision, then you might object to that. You might find it, you know, like, hey, well, I don't quite believe that. But the evidence is overwhelming. It's true, actually. It's a fact. It's a beautiful fact.
Neuroplasticity has been one of the themes that we've spent quite a bit of time on this show, and we talked about that experiment where they rewired the ferret's brain so that the, I can't remember, is it the auditory cortex to the eyes or something like that?
I don't remember the details either, but I know the experiment you're talking about. It's famous.
So the animal was able to see with its auditory cortex, I think was the bottom line, which...
Yes.
That's a real attention getter.
So you see it in humans. If a human is born with trauma to the eyes, for example, then the area of the cortex, which is normally used for vision, becomes tactile. You see that in trauma, and you see it in birth defects. There's tremendous evidence for it. The brain is very plastic, and essentially cortex is cortex, and it'll look for patterns in whatever is available. So it's an amazing, it's a wonderful sort of idea, and I always enjoy thinking about it. It's just a beautiful idea, and there's lots of evidence support it.
Getting back to your book, one of the starting places that you worked from was the contention that behavior is not an adequate measure of intelligence. I loved the quote, and I'm going to say that for the sake of my audience, it's on page 33, where you said, intelligence is something happening in your head. Behavior is an optional ingredient. Why have you concluded then that memory and prediction are keys to understanding intelligence?
Well, boy, you're asking me to recall how I got to certain beliefs about this, and it's a little bit difficult for me to do. For example, the prediction we've already mentioned, that prediction had to be important because it's so prevalent in the neuroanatomy of the brain. So that was a starting function. When I first started thinking about prediction feedback, I didn't know what we think about feedback. But I've always had the sense that the brain was about memory, because I just knew that when you were born, you didn't know stuff, and now when you through life, you're learning things, and in order to just even understand a visual scene, like what's in front of me right now with buildings and cars and trains and so on, I have to have all this memory. So clearly memory is an important function of it. The reason I'm talking about behavior is because so much what was done in thinking about thinking or intelligent machines or even neuroscience was influenced by people like Alan Turing, who proposed the Turing test, which was to say we know if a machine was intelligent if it had this outward behavior that we couldn't tell it was different from a human. you see a lot of philosophical arguments, people like John Searle, who wrote about the Chinese room experiment, and so on. This is all about behavior. People are thinking like, well, we'll know that something's intelligent if it has the correct behavior. And that's always just sort of seemed to me intuitively wrong, that humans can be very smart without having any behavior. We do that all the time. People listening to this podcast don't have to be doing anything to be smart and understand what we're talking about. And behavior, you can have all kinds of behavior that isn't really very smart at all, and you can fool people. So in my journey through life, I was trying to find out things and assumptions that we were making that might be wrong. So this whole behavioral paradigm, the Turing test, to me seemed like that's a red herring. Don't fall for that. And then the prediction thing came about later, and I could talk about that if you want, but I've already spent a lot of time on that one. Last question.
Do you think we need the prediction to, in order to be able to talk about your memory prediction framework, or do you need any to put any background in there?
I'll try it now, sure. In my book, I describe an aha moment that occurred to me many years ago. I was very confused about what brains actually do. It seems a silly question to say, what does a brain do? But when you actually try to pin it down and nail it, it becomes difficult to do that. And I was in my office at home one day, and I had this experiment. I described this in the book, this experience where I realized that there's so many things in the world that if they were just slightly different than normal, I would notice them. And I had this aha moment that essentially said, you know what, we are making predictions about the world all the time, about everything. You predict what words you're going to hear. For example, because you understand English, you can predict what word is at the end of this sentence. And it just happens to you all the time. And when you touch things, you have expectations about what they're going to feel like and their temperature and their texture. As you walk, you have expectations about where your feet are going to stop and what it's going to feel like. So it became clear to me that brains are making these massive predictions about things all the time, and you're not generally conscious of it. You only become conscious of it when an expectation or prediction fails. So all of a sudden something happens that was unusual or wasn't predicted, then your attention is drawn to it. But you're making predictions through all your senses all the time through your waking life. And this, to me, was another big clue. I said, okay, so I have this brain, and it's a memory system of some sort. At the time, I didn't know how it worked, but I said, it has to be making constant predictions about things, and it's making constant predictions about novel things, things it's never seen before, exact details it's never seen before. So if I put my hand down on some table, it may be a new table, and I've maybe never been in that exact situation, but my brain still makes predictions about it. So I think, how could a brain make predictions about novel things based on past experience? So these are sort of clues that I was collecting, which led to the theory that eventually came out in the book and which we've been working on since.
I want to talk about the memory prediction framework, but I'm wondering if we've left out any pieces.
Yeah, there's a couple of pieces that are big clues that are important for me. One was the role of time. Many theories, whether they were brain theories or whether they were computer science type theories, they ignored time. People who created neural networks, they mostly ignored time. And the logic for this very much relates to vision, because when people say, look, I can look at a picture and I can flash a picture in front of someone's face, and they can recognize what it is, and there's no time involved in that. They argue, well, we can probably not think about time right now. We can try to understand, for example, computer vision or human vision without thinking about time. But if you think about your other senses, such as hearing and touch, you can't do anything without time. You really can't do any sort of high-level recognition or language or processing or auditory sounds without flowing through time. And you can't do the same with touch. I can't really touch something and know what it is unless I move my fingers over. And most vision itself is time-based. So as I look at the world, things are moving all the time, my head's moving all the time. So that was another clue that to me was, hey, look, any theory about brain function has to intimately be involved with how patterns flow through time. And if you're not doing that, you're not going to capture it, because brains are working with time-based data. And then finally, one of the pieces that came together late for me was knowing that the neocortex itself has a particular structure to it, has an organization, which we call hierarchical. If you looked at all the different regions of the neocortex and how they're connected together, they have a organizational structure that looks like an inverted tree, like a big pyramid sort of shape to it. That is, there's a whole bunch of regions that project to a whole bunch of regions, projects a whole bunch of regions. So there's this hierarchical structure to the neocortex. And if you took the hierarchical structure, feedback, and time, and prediction, and you put them all together and you think about it for a while, you can figure out how the whole thing works.
Do we need to talk anything about how patterns are stored?
Well, we can get into the theory that I proposed in the book and that we've been developing since then, if you want. It turns out that in order to, for any kind of memory system to make a prediction of any sort, it has to store how patterns change through time. And so it has to store sequences of things. You can think of an easy example of a pattern that exists in time is like a melody. You can't recognize a melody by hearing one note. You have to hear it through time. And you can only make a prediction like, what's the next note I'm going to hear in the melody, if you've been exposed and remembered how the patterns move through time, how the notes move through time. So one of the key elements of this theory, the memory prediction framework, is that what the brain is storing is sequences of patterns. So it's like, you can think of them like little songs, little melodies, but we do it for not just for auditory, we do it for vision, and we do it for tactile somatosensory inputs as well. It's a theory about how memories are formed by storing sequences of patterns through time in a hierarchical memory structure.
Okay, so do you want to tell my listeners your elevator description of the theory? And then we can expand?
Is there an elevator description of the theory? Yeah, we touched on most of the bases of it so far. Essentially, the neocortex, and we're talking about the neocortex, not the other parts of the brain, it is this massive memory structure. As I said earlier, it stores almost everything you know about the world. And you know a lot about the world. All the details, everything. It's all there. And essentially what happens in this theory, you have this memory structure. It's shaped like a hierarchy, meaning there's memory regions that are close to the sensory input, and there's other memory regions that are one step away, and other memory regions are one step away from that. And what basic operation is, the simplest way I could describe it, is each section in the memory is trying to store sequences of patterns. The ones at the bottom of the hierarchy, the ones closest to your eyes, your ears, your senses, they store little sequences in time over little parts of space. So it'd be like in the auditory world, you might imagine little sounds that are blips going up and down and so on. In the visual world, it'd be little lines moving left and right at different parts of your visual field. These have all been documented in neurophysiological studies. And then what happens is these little sequences that are learned at one level, they get passed to the next level up. But what gets passed up is like the name of the sequence. It's not the details. You can think of it like a melody. So if I'm in a little section of cortex and I see a sequence of patterns, I say, oh, I recognize a sequence of patterns. What I pass to my parent, the next region up in the hierarchy, is the name of it. It's a constant representation. So the parent region is looking at sequences of sequences. And then the next region up looks at sequences of sequences of sequences and so on. So the end result is when you have a memory system like this, and it, in self-training, when you have a very fast changing patterns at the bottom, like my speech or like what's entering your eyes when you scan around the world, as information flows up the cortical hierarchy, it becomes slower and slower. And at the top, you find the cells responding to slower concepts in some sense. And this system, when you build a system like this and you train it the way we train a human, you expose it to patterns, it ends up building a model of the world. The end result is you have a model of the world. All the things you know about the world are stored in this memory model. And it's a hierarchical model. So the model consists of things that are low-level details in the world, and then higher-level details and higher-level details still. That's kind of the best I can do for an elevator pitch. It's a hierarchical memory model. You expose it to patterns, and it learns the structure of the world by basically learning what patterns flow through time together. And it does this in a hierarchical fashion. And believe it or not, that can explain an awful lot about human behavior, about how we learn, about how we think, about how we make predictions, and so on.
So when you say you're having an experience and you're sending the information's going up the hierarchy, the higher levels are then feeding back what they expect to happen next?
That's right. So the first thing you do is you have a new input coming in on your senses. And it's interesting to think about that. In your life, you'll never have the same pattern on your retina twice in your life. Even if you looked at your husband, your wife over and over and over again, it's always different every time. So you have these novel patterns coming in. And then immediately the brain says, do I recognize these patterns? And do I recognize the low-level details and the next-level details and so on? And in almost all cases, it says, yes, I know what's going on. It says at the top of the level hierarchy, you say, okay, that's my husband or that's a dog or whatever, so on. But the brain in every region can make predictions about what's going to happen next because every region is stored sequences. And so every region is saying, I know what's likely to happen next at the high level, at the low level, the middle levels, and so on. And it feeds those predictions down the hierarchy. And it basically says, you know what, you should be expecting to be seeing this at this point in time, and you should be expecting to be seeing this at this point in time. This is useful for a number of reasons. It makes you, it clarifies confusing data that's coming in. So if you're seeing something that ambiguous, your brain doesn't want to see it as ambiguous. It basically says, you know what, I'm going to interpret it in one way or the other, and it tells all the regions below it, interpret it this way. So we see that in bistable patterns, like little staircase drawings or the Necker cube, if you know what those are. So prediction is an important part of this whole process. And prediction also is how we think, because if I want to just silently think about something, what our brain is doing is it's taking its current state, its current belief, and says, what would likely happen next? And you can turn that prediction and ignore the real data from your senses, but take the prediction and feed it back into the memory and say, well, what would happen next? And what would happen next? And so you can follow a series of basically memory predictions. And that's what thinking is. That's when you're practicing a speech or thinking about what's going to happen tonight when you come home. The brain is just following a series of predictions and can walk through a series of imagined activities.
One thing I like about your theory is that it explains so much of our day-to-day experience. Like why when something changes, it catches our attention. You can enter a room and the one thing you notice is the thing that wasn't there.
Yeah, and it goes back to this idea that you're making these massively parallel predictions about so much in the world and you're not thinking about it. The intuition, our intuition is like, oh, I look at the world and I see things. You know, but there's magic in that. It's very complex, but you actually, what you're seeing is you're looking at the world, you're comparing it to your memory of the world, and your brain is saying, is this right? And if something, even the slightest little thing changes, you'll notice it. I have a coffee cup sitting in front of me right now, and it's round. But if that coffee cup was even the slightest bit off round, it was slightly, just a teeny bit oval shaped, I'd immediately notice that. And I'd say, it's wrong. And that basically is telling me my brain knows what it's supposed to look like in great detail, has memory of this object, and it says, it should look differently than that. It should be looked. And so your brain is doing this all the time, but you're not consciously aware of it. It explains a lot of our behavior. It explains how we think and how we notice things.
And why when your power goes out, it wakes you up?
Yeah. I'm not sure you're referring to exactly what you're referring to on that question. But
well, haven't you ever had the experience of, you know, you're asleep and your electricity goes out and you wake up and you wonder, well, why does the absence of all the...
Yes. You know, there's an interesting story, which I don't know if it's true, but I like to repeat it anyway. In New York, they used to have elevated trains like they have in Chicago, and they no longer have the elevated trains. And I think there was an elevated train that used to run up 3rd Avenue. And the night they stopped running the trains, the very first night they stopped running the trains, the police station was getting calls in the middle of the night, lots of calls. And all the calls came in at certain times. And it came in at the times when the trains would have passed people's houses, people's apartments. And so what people would wake up in the middle of the night, and they said, something's wrong, and something woke me up. And they called the police station. Well, the only thing that was wrong is there was no sound. There was no train going by. I'd like to believe it's true. I can't find the original source for it, but it's the same thing. I could believe it.
Yeah, it fits anyway. It sounds believable.
It's amazing. We have our model of the world is really good, and it knows so many things we're just not conscious aware of. And when things change, even the absence of something, we say, oh, what's going on here?
I know your focus is on the cortex, but I have talked a bit about memory in the podcast in the past. Could you just say something about where the hippocampus fits in, even though it's not part of the cortex?
Yeah, so there are a few parts of the brain that are intimately related to the neocortex. The hippocampus is one, the thalamus is another, basal ganglia is a collection of organs of others. And we study all these. We have a model for hippocampal interaction with the brain. Now, people think of the hippocampus as very important for forming new memories, and that's true. It isn't the ultimate location for most memories. So, for example, if you don't have a hippocampus, you will not form new memories. However, if you lose your hippocampus, the memories you formed in the past are not lost. It's not an ultimate repository for memories, but it seems to be very critical in forming them. I think we understand how this works with the neocortex, and I'll try to describe it as simply as I can. One of the things that the neocortical memory model that we have developed does is, as you're observing the world, it has to throw away details as the information goes up the hierarchy. So I want to recognize my dog, but I don't want to recognize every little hair and mitten nose. I don't want to be conscious of all that stuff. And so as the information flows up the hierarchy, you lose data. You essentially throw it away at different levels as you get to concepts at the top. And the hippocampus sits next to the neocortex physically and conceptually. And it looks like the hippocampus is very good at forming instantaneous memories. It's like saying I can take a flash recognition of something and just remember these bits, remember this data right now. What the hippocampus can do is it can look at the state of the neocortex and remember all the state, the entire state of it. It's like saying, okay, I want to remember what's going on right now. And it can remember parts at the top and parts in the middle of the neocortex, so it can remember a lot of data that the neocortex itself doesn't remember. And it saves it off to the side, in some sense, there's other little memory structures. And what the hippocampus can do is it can then reinstate that memory in the neocortex. It's like saying, go back to where we were earlier, reinstate this, and it can basically make you think of details that you would have forgotten otherwise. So the way of thinking about this is, in the normal way of operation, the neocortex is fairly slow to form memories. And most of the time, it doesn't try to remember all the details. The hippocampus can say, I'm going to remember the details throughout your day. I'm going to remember those details. And I can reinstate them back in the neocortex, so you can think about them if you want to. But they only get permanently transferred back to the neocortex if they're important. So let me give you an example. You probably had lunch today. All the listeners had lunch today or yesterday. And you can probably remember what you had for lunch. You can think about it. You say, oh, yeah, I remember I had some rice and a soda. Now, if you ask me a week from now, I have no idea what I had for lunch. And if you ask me a year from now, I have no idea. But that information had to be stored very rapidly someplace. And so it's stored in the hippocampus. It's like saying, okay, there's some details. I'm going to store it there. But if I don't use it again, I'm going to forget it. And therefore, it's not important enough for the neocortex to remember. It's not part of my world model that I had rice for lunch today. It's not that essential. Now, if I had rice every day for lunch or something really important happened while I had rice, then I would want to remember it. But the hippocampus gives us that temporary memory that says, here's something important, here's something that happened that probably is not important. I'm going to remember it for a short period of time. And only later, if it really is important, will we transfer it back into the neocortex and reinstate that so the neocortex can learn it over and over again. We've modeled this in our software, and it works pretty well, actually. It does work just like that.
So you've been, since you wrote On Intelligence, really focusing on building software that implements the theory. Are we ready to talk a little bit about that?
Sure. I don't want anyone to get the impression that we've sort of given up on the neuroscience side of this. So since I wrote my book, I've had many, many interactions with experimentalists and theoretical neuroscientists about what they like about the book, and we've progressed the theory quite a bit. I haven't given up on that, but I decided a number of years ago that one of the best ways to get people to work on these theories, work on the theoretical side of neuroscience, is to turn it into a technology that's useful. And I'm using the Silicon Valley computer world type of model, and I can get lots of people working on the technology if it solves some problems. I can get them working on it much faster than I can through academic means of just purely publishing papers and so on. So I've been approaching this from two sides at once, and we created a company called Numenta, which is taking this theory and implementing it in software and building machines that work like the neocortex, having some good success with it. A lot of this work came from a colleague of mine named Billy George, who was a Stanford graduate student who did the math. And when I wrote the book, I didn't know how to do this. I didn't know how to build it at that time. But very shortly after the book was published, we figured this out, much to Luke's work. We said, okay, let's build this stuff. And it's exciting, and it's useful. And so I've been spending most of my time, but not all of it, working on that.
Several months ago, I interviewed Rolf Pfeiffer. He also wrote a book, but his was focused on embodied artificial intelligence. And he said that one of the advantages of actually building things was then you can't cheat the rules, and then you have to see what really works. And from that, you can then go back and have a better understanding of what the brain's really doing.
Yes, you have to match them. Also, Carl Lamine has a great quote I use. I'll have to paraphrase it right now. But he basically says, you don't really understand something until you can build it. You know, there's a lot of people have theories about different brain things and so on. But in my mind, if it doesn't match the neuroscience and you can't build it, then you really don't understand it. So there's a real advantage in building this stuff and seeing what happens. As we've been building the software and testing it, it helps the theory and it goes back to the biology because we're seeing things we see in neuroscience that the software is doing that we didn't expect. And all of a sudden, oh, yeah, that's, you know, we find that in the brain too. And the theory and experimentation go together pretty well.
Is there anything that you've discovered that's really surprised you?
There's a couple of things that I won't say they're dramatically important, but you asked what surprised me. And there's a few things that surprised me. One of the things that surprised me is as we started building these memory models and training them, that's how we basically design a memory system and then we train it on, like, we showed movies, literally, of pictures of things moving and so on, to build a vision system. We found that it takes a long time to train them. Much longer than it takes to do the recognition. So it may take me days to train one of our memory systems, but I can recognize things, that is, show you or make predictions about things in just a second or a tenth of a second, but it may take me days or hours to train the system. And this is the fundamental property of these systems. And then I went back and I said, well, I shouldn't have been surprised by that because that's what humans are like. You know, I never thought of this. I never asked the question, why does it take 18 years to train a child? I used to think like, well, the brain is growing and the body's not ready. But now the theory says, no, it takes a long time because it takes a long time. And that's just how the memories are formed, and there's nothing you can do about that. Another surprising thing was, as we got into these models, we're building them, we can tweak the parameters a lot. We can try different things. And one of the things we can do is we can take these memories and we can make them go between two extremes. One extreme is sort of like what brains do. We don't want to remember all the details, but we want to generalize. So I don't remember all the details of everything I've done in my life, but I've learned to model the world and I generalize very well. But if we tweak it the other way, we can make these memories remember all the details, but they don't generalize well.
Just like people.
Well, it's like savantism.
Right.
People who have savant syndrome, which is often associated with autism, but other diseases as well, they can remember huge amounts of data. Like there are documented savants who can remember every word in 5,000 books. Every word on every page. Now, they have a brain like you and I do. It's not some magic thing. They have a brain, but somehow it's slightly different. Struck me as like, all of a sudden I have a model for that. I said, look, I can make our models do the same thing. It's an easy tweak. You just turn this parameter a bit, and all of a sudden they start remembering all the details, but they don't generalize. And that's what savants don't do. They don't generalize well. They don't get jokes. They don't see the context of things, but they remember the details extremely well. So that was a surprise. It's something that came out of experimentation, which I didn't expect. So there were things like that, which I enjoyed finding.
I noticed on your website, the Numenta website, I mean, and I haven't really had a chance to explore it in any detail, that you have some software out now for people to use. Is that for developers or?
Yeah, it's computer science-y stuff, but essentially what this software lets someone do is to, a computer scientist or an electrical engineer type of person. It's not easy, I'm putting it that way. These are very technical tools. But it allows you to configure a memory system that's hierarchical and works on the principles that we think the neocortex works on, and allows them to train it with some sort of data. So they can make a vision system, they can feed in auditory data, they can feed in financial information, and so on. And what the system will do is it'll build a model of that data to try to figure out what the underlying causes of the structure of that data is. It can then do what we call inferences, this pattern recognition. It can make predictions about the future. And these are very useful things. There's many, many problems in the world where people have data. They have sensory data that of some sort, and they don't know how to process it. They don't know how to extract useful information out of it. They don't know how to make predictions from it. And so this software gives you tools to do that in the way that the brain does. It's just getting started. We've had our first set of tools out there appeared about a year ago, and they're pretty limited. But we have somewhere between 100 and 200 people using it pretty much on a regular basis. We have a new set of software coming out very shortly, within a month, which is much, much better and has much more capabilities. There's a lot of interest. There's many, many people who are experimenting with this stuff and really looking for solutions to problems that brains can do, but they haven't really been able to do on computers before. And this fits the bill for many of them.
It seems to me like your work is very complementary to the work of the people that are doing the kind of robotics that's based on the importance of embodiment, because that's another aspect of how brains really work.
Yes.
Is that they're in bodies.
That's right. It is complementary to that. There's a lot of roboticists who are interested in what we're doing. You know, I think anybody who takes biology seriously and says, you know what, if I'm going to build a robot, I've got to know something about how biological systems do this, how neurons do this stuff, and how brains do this. Anybody who takes that philosophy, we have commonality between them because that's what we're doing. I believe all the stuff we're building is very biologically realistic. It's not just plausible, it's realistic. It's actually modeling what's going on in the cortex. And so people who have a similar sort of philosophy, it is complementary in many ways. We personally at Numenta have not focused on robotics because to build robotic systems, there's a lot of other engineering that has to be done. And we're trying to do things such as computer vision and understanding language and so on, that doesn't require a body as much as like a robot does. We're picking problems that we think we can attack quicker and easier without a lot of other engineering.
You're building tools that it sounds like eventually the people that are doing robotics will be able to use.
Yes, that's right. In fact, the theory, and this was not in my book because I didn't understand it at the time, but I understand it a lot better now, and there's some information on our website about this. The theory of the memory prediction framework, which we call today, we have a different term for it, we call hierarchical temporal memory, but it's the same thing. That theory can explain how it is we generate complex motor behavior, how I'm generating my speech right now. It's all part of the same thing. Everyone in your cortex is involved in motor behavior. That's an area that we really love to explore more, embedding these artificial neocortexes in behavioral bodies. But we haven't done it yet, but we think we understand the theory well enough that we could do it in the not-too-distant future.
So that's one of the things that you're kind of hoping you'll be able to do in the future. What's the unanswered question that occupies your mind now? Is there one or many?
There are many. Most of them are pretty detailed. I'll tell you one that might be interesting to your listeners. This is a brain-related, you know, as opposed to a mathematical type of thing. The theory that we're developing says a lot about how neocortex stores sequences and makes predictions and so on. And this, has to be done by neurons. That's all the brain has. It's got neurons. And so all the components of this theory have to be implemented in neurons. And one of the things I'm focusing on right now is neurons have complex dendrites, or what they're called dendritic trees. This is where all the synapses are. And this is where memory is formed. And there are several ways neurons could implement the basics of the theory that we're working on. And I'm searching for and working on trying to really narrow that down, really try to understand exactly how neurons work. And there are theories about neurons and how they work, but most of those theories are very vague about why neurons have so many synapses. A typical neuron might have 1,000 or 10,000 or even 50,000 synapses. And most neural network theories and most brain theories can't really explain why they have so many. Our theories can. They can explain why that very clearly, why cells have these complex dendritic trees. And so I've kind of come to a better understanding right now, you know, a real theory of neurons. You know, why do they look the way they are? And can I make predictions about exactly how those dendritic trees work? And I think this can be done. We're not too far from it. But that's a problem I'm thinking about. I've been asked to write a paper for the Royal Society Biological Journal. And I want to write about that. And so I've been focusing on that just recently.
That sounds like a real interesting question. I look forward to hearing about what you discover. I hope you'll keep me informed. Are you getting pressed for time?
Not particularly, no. Not at the moment. But I would like to mention that people do want to know more about what we're doing. If they read my book and they want to know more about what's happened since the book came out, they should go to the Nemento website. And there's a lot of information up there. There are talks that we have up there. There are white papers. There's a lot of description of the stuff we've been talking about. Some of it's a fairly high-level description. Some of it's pretty detailed. Anyone could sign up for our newsletter, which you're going to get about once a quarter, which basically just says what's new at Nemento and where we are with our releases and so on. So people who are interested in that should check that out.
I will put a link to your website in my show notes, so we'll definitely do that. Now, I had sort of one sort of off-the-side question I wanted to ask you if you had time.
Sure.
I'm sure you're familiar with Antonio Damasio's work with emotions and the importance of emotions for people in making good decisions. I just wonder, since your focus is sort of staying away from that part, and you did a really good job in the book of explaining that you're not trying to make a human brain, you're trying to make an intelligent machine, which are two different things. You're not trying to model the brain.
I'm trying to model neocortex, not an entire brain, yes.
Right. So obviously to make a soluble problem, you've had to leave out parts.
Yeah.
Do you think that when you're trying to model decision-making with the neocortex, this issue of emotional inputs has any importance?
It surely does. Just to give the listeners some basis of this, there are many parts, several parts of the brain that are intimately involved in emotion. There's a part called the amygdala, which has to do with fear, for example. These are older parts of the brain, older than the neocortex. They're generally fairly small, so the amygdala is like the size of an almond or something like that. And they interact with the neocortex. But the neocortex itself doesn't mediate these emotions. It's sort of like when you are fearful, the amygdala emits certain patterns and chemicals and so on that makes you fearful. But the basic theory that we have is that the amygdala has to learn what are fearful things in the world and then create reactions that are appropriate. And so it has to look at what's going on in the neocortex, because the neocortex is how the amygdala or any other part of the brain can know what's actually going on out there. And you see that. You see the neocortex from all different parts of the neocortex projects to this little structure called, you know, the amygdala, another emotional centers of the brain. The point of this is the neocortex itself does not do emotions. It interacts with emotional systems in the brain. It's sort of the rational part of your brain. It says, you know, I should do this. This is the way the world is working. And the neocortex itself doesn't make you hungry or fearful or lustful or something like that. So we have modeled emotions in our systems in a very, very simple way. For example, when we train our neocortical models, when we train them, we have a switch that says, you know, this is important to learn, and then we can turn the switch off and say, this isn't important to learn. It's not important, or it is important. We don't have to, you know, model all the stuff that these other parts of the brain do, trying to judge what's important to a human or not important to a human. We just say, it's time to learn and not time to learn. And that works very well for what we're doing. If I want to make a vision system or a system that understands language, I can do it that way. Now, if I want to embed this in a product that's making decisions about the world, well, we'd have to have something equivalent to those other emotional centers of the brain. If I'm making a system that works like the neocortex and it's trying to understand, say, financial markets and trying to make predictions about financial markets and maybe trying to decide whether you should make an investment in or not, well, it has to have some sort of emotional saliency to good investments and bad investments or things that go up or go down. But that's outside of your cortex, and someone can build that anywhere they want. It's not sort of core to the theory about how brains represent knowledge. You'll never really need to model the specific emotional centers in the human brain unless you wanted to make something that's like a human. But we're not trying to do that, and so I don't think that we will have to model them in the future. We do have to have some equivalent, and today our equivalent is really simple. It's just, you know, some engineer flipping a switch.
Thank you. That answers that question. Do you have anything else you'd like to tell my listeners before we sign off?
Yeah, the other thing I would like to suggest is that I believe that the kind of work we're doing at Nemento, and there's other people doing similar work, but the kind of work we're doing at Nemento is really the beginning of an entire new era in both brain science and computing science. It's sort of like when people built the first computer 60 years ago. We were at that era. We have the basic idea about how these systems should work and the kind of problems they can solve. And we're just getting them working, and I believe there's going to be many decades of exciting advancements going on in here. And 30 years from now, even 20 years from now, this is going to be a huge industry, and our knowledge about how these systems work will be so far advanced from where they are today. And I mention that because if there's young people listening who are so inclined, whether you're in computer science or engineering or neuroscience, and you're thinking about entering this field, I would encourage them to do that. I would say this is going to be one of the most exciting fields to work in, whether you're doing from the neuroscience world or from the computer science world. And if you're just thinking about your career, study up, read this stuff, and I would encourage you to get involved. We could use lots of smart people working on these things.
Do you have any specific advice for students that think they might want to get involved in this area?
Well, it depends on whether they're going to get involved from the neuroscience side or the computer science side. It's easier from the computer science side. I would just say become knowledgeable about these things, study a little bit of neuroscience, learn some probability theory because there's a lot of Bayesian mathematics that we use in these things. But mostly, you know, you can just start with my book, start in the mental re-up. We have lots of links to other resources they could read. You can study cognitive theory in college these days. You can study neuroscience. You need to learn a lot of different things. But, you know, it's like the beginning of the computer era, and there's no career path that's well-defined. You just have to say, I'm going to work on these things. I want to get involved. You know, I have a lot of people who read my book who contact me still, lots of people around the world. And many of them have started initiatives based on the book. Some of them want to work here. We've actually hired some interns who basically said, I went to college to study this because of your book. Now they're going to come work at NUMENTA. And so there's lots of opportunities. If you're excited about it, you think it's great, just study what's available. And I'm just saying it's a great career choice, I believe it would be.
Thank you. And I really appreciate you taking the time to come on the podcast. And I hope I'll be able to talk to you again. Enjoyed getting to talk with Jeff Hawkins, and I will have a link to the NUMENTA website in my show notes at brainsciencepodcast.com. Don't forget to check out the latest episode of Books and Ideas, which is episode 20 at booksandideas.com, which is the interview with Delaney Dean about meditation. Next month, we'll be having the interview with Michael Arbib, and also our semi-annual six-month review episode. I would like to encourage those of you who haven't been to the website at brainsciencepodcast.com to visit the website. It's really a blog, so you can actually subscribe to the feed from the website separately, and you will automatically not only get show notes, but also posts that I put up in between episodes, such as links to other good science podcasts. There's also information on the website for how you can contribute to supporting the Brain Science Podcast. There are links to our Facebook group and also to our Brain Science Podcast community on Flickr for those of you who like to share your photography. I've been running into quite a few listeners on Facebook, and I would like to remind you, if you send me a friend request, it's a good idea to send me a message telling me that you are a Brain Science Podcast listener. Same thing if you send me email at docartemis@gmail.com. Be sure to put something like Brain Science Podcast in your subject line. That way your email won't get thrown into the junk by my email filter. I love getting emails, and I appreciate people who post comments on the website. But the best place to leave your feedback is at the discussion forum at brainscienceforum.com. It's a great place to meet other listeners and share your ideas, and it's much better for getting a conversation going. I've mentioned in the past that Diane Jacobs has been doing some transcribing of episodes, and she did Yuri Bishaki's episode, which was episode 31. She's just recently finished a transcription of the interview of Christoph Koch. So if you were one that felt that he talked rather rapidly
and had an accent, you might want to check out that transcript. I have added a link to her transcript in the show notes for that episode. That was episode 22. Last but not least, let me remind you about the new website, sciencepodcasters.org, which is a group blog for science podcasts of all sizes. We're still looking for new members, so if you have a favorite science podcast or you're a science podcaster, go to sciencepodcasters.org, check out the requirements for joining, and if you're interested, send me an email at docartemis@gmail.com. I want to thank those of you who have participated in the audience survey. I did get some feedback from somebody who found the survey to be quite boring, which I can't really disagree with since it's really aimed at the kind of demographic information that potential advertisers are interested in. But I still appreciate those of you who have done that and would ask you that when you visit the website, if you haven't done the survey, click on the survey button, which you will see on the left sidebar at brainsciencepodcast.com. I appreciate your listening, and I look forward to talking to you again in a couple of weeks. The Brain Science Podcast is copyright 2008 Virginia Campbell, MD. You may copy this podcast to share it with others, but for any other uses or derivatives, please contact me at docartemis@gmail.com.